Will robots be better teachers than humans?
I want to say true and false. If we understand teachers to be the teachers of today, I think it's both true and false.
Can education prepare us for jobs that don't exist yet?
For me, it's true and false.
Should schools teach students how to fail?
Yes.
Welcome to the 38th episode of the Skills Factory, talks and ideas about skills from Europe and beyond. In the recent podcast, we've discussed the topic of artificial intelligence and its impact on the future of education. Today, we'll continue the discussion about the future. What will the schools of the future look like? How will the teaching profession evolve? Our learning environments, schools, universities are changing continuously. And we're happy to have today with us the future's literacy expert, Riel Miller. Hi, Riel. Thanks for coming.
Hello. Very glad to be here. Thank you.
So, dear listeners, get comfy and let's imagine the future together. Riel, how do you see the future of education in 5-10 years from now?
Well, it's a question that actually I've been thinking about for most of my career. When I first started doing work on the future, I was asked to conduct a large study into the future of education, in this case in Ontario. I'm from Canada. And the desire that was being expressed then is not dissimilar from the desire that's being expressed today, which is, how can education prepare us for the future? What changes do we need to make so that education will work better and be more effective and better for the students, better for the parents, better for the community? And I have to say that overall, the basic contours of the management of knowledge creation and knowledge diffusion, so the transmission, preservation, the creation of new ideas and new knowledge, that structure, that system is a power system, an institutional system. And it's an integral part of the overall social and economic and political systems, cultural systems that we live in. And it's one of the characteristics, I think, of the last 50 years or more, really, since the end of the Second World War, perhaps the mid-20th century, that there's been a period of what seems to me to be relative stability, continuity. Things are going in the right direction. We can improve it. Television is going to be a fantastic resource for education, or AI is going to be a fantastic resource for education, etc.
The amount of information we are facing now and the learners are facing now is, what, 100 times more? What about education as being a source of information? Is it in the past?
I often say, when people talk about the world going fast, can you run faster than you can run? Oh, no, I can't run faster than I can run because I'll fall on my face. Well, are you doing things in the world today faster than you can? No, because you're doing it the way you can do it. Are you deciding to do it? Yes. Are you being forced to? Well, maybe by example, maybe by pressure, maybe by anxiety, maybe by something. But it's based on capability here. And I don't think that there's more information in the world today. We're creating more iterations, more permutations, perhaps, but we're also capable, there's more of us for one thing, but we're also capable of doing the triage and of playing with it and thinking about it. But the real question is, what do you do with it? What do you value? What do you pay attention to? What do you feel gives meaning? Where do you find sense? I live the fastest, the most difficult, the most incredible. No, I'm sorry. I'm sure somebody said that in the year 200, in the year 1500, in the year 1939. If we're going to understand the idea of the future, we have to understand past, present, and future. And we have to understand what it is we're talking about. When I talk about the past, I'm talking about my interpretation of evidence that I have available and stories that have been told. I can't go to check it. I can't go and back there. And when I'm in the present, what is driving my attention? What am I afraid of? When people talk about images of the future that they feel afraid of, very often they don't want to examine where that idea of the future came from. Why do they think it's important to have a lot of people who can make horseshoes? We need a lot of blacksmiths. Look at all the horses in the city today. There's so many horses in the city, the city's falling apart. This was a genuine concern at the end of the 19th century. New York and London were falling apart because there were too many horses and you needed a lot of blacksmiths.
So do you think that the fears about, for instance, artificial intelligence and its impact on education are following that path of, you know, just being worried because of the too many horses in London.
Yeah, I just spent the last 2 months at Stanford in Palo Alto. This is the forefront of the thinking in Silicon Valley, the epicenter of this and many other hype cycles. For now, and I'm not talking about things like sentience or Skynet, which remain, in my view, still fantasies, but I'm talking about a tool. And for now, maybe AI will be able to replicate autonomously and become conscious and do things. But for now, what we're looking at is a tool, and that tool is contingent on how the tool is used.
Do you think our education systems are ready to embrace that new technology, that new innovation, such as AI, for instance? Because it requires quite some certain skills from teachers and certain skills from learners as well. Do you think we're ready for fully embracing AI?
Look, I mean, the question is how do we incorporate the latest advance in the Walkman so that you have autonomous, independent headphones and you can listen to courses and classes? How do you flip the classroom? How do you deal with MOOCs? I mean, we've heard this over and over again every time there's a new tool. And new tools do open up new opportunities, so there's no question. But again, our ability to understand those opportunities, our ability to make use of those opportunities is dependent on the way we function. And those aspects of the system change very, very slowly. I don't think we create these systems. They're not the result of some decision. The Lord of the Castle in Bruges decided that he was going to be the founder of capitalism when he established the rules of the marketplace in his chateau. No, he was not thinking, oh, ha-ha, I'm taking the first step on the road to capitalism. The advent of universal compulsory schooling, when we decided to create these school systems, people didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know why they were doing them. They had some arguments. They had some insights. They had some problems. There was a difficulty with peasants moving into the city and workers working in factories. And it turns out that there was this real problem about turning up on time. Nobody had a watch. Nobody listened to the clock. Why should I? If I'm a farmer and a peasant, and the sun comes up, the things to do, you have a different rhythm of life. So we had a whole series of issues in transitional terms as society evolved. And it did not evolve on a grand plan. And it did not evolve because somebody said, aha, I've got a great idea. Let's do it this way. It evolved through experimentation, failure. It will be the same for education systems and the same for political systems and the same for the world, because we live in an emergent, creative, complex universe.
But what about all those policymakers that believe that they build the systems? They believe they take the initiative and they invent laws and legislation. What about all of them?
I hear you. And what about ideology and what about utopias and what about all sorts of things? I think it's clearly it's a very important part of what we do. But I think it would be worthwhile being a little bit more humble, a little bit more aware that by casting ourselves in this role of colonizing the future, being able to impose our idea today, which is based on the past, on tomorrow, is not necessarily the best way to go. And that we create tremendous path dependency, tremendous brittleness and fragility by basically looking for options which will say, I'm going to be right. So what's a good policy-making option if you want to be right? Build a pyramid. Build a big, big, big pyramid that's really heavy and nobody can move or touch, and it'll last 5,000 years, and you'll be right as a policymaker because it's heavy and big and it stays there. But this locks us in. This makes us brittle. It makes us not agile. It makes it difficult for us to respond, to adapt, take advantage of new tools in new ways, to change relationships. And fundamentally, I think the pretension of policy, which is rooted in the pretensions of the nation state, is something that really deprives us of our greatest strength, which is difference. And the ability to cultivate difference is a much stronger strategy for resilience, because it's one that ensures more creativity, more innovation, more experimentation. Of course, there will be failures. And of course, there will be things that don't work and that die out. But birth and death and diversity are squarely part of this universe. That's what our planet's about. And you and I, we're all living at a moment when our planet that doesn't have an ideology or a conscious, purpose that I know of, is simply sending us a message, holding up a mirror to our species and saying, if you continue to behave like this, you will destroy your own nest, not the Earth's nest, the Earth will keep on going, but your own nest, your own home. You're destroying the conditions of your own home. Why are you doing that? What is it about humans in the way we are now that make us horrible for other creatures, other living organisms, and also make us very horrible to each other? And so I think there's some very profound and basic questions that we need to ask in the context of today's changes.
There is a thing that I hear a lot from experts in education, and most of them say that the future of educational learning is the personalized learning pathway. Then I do a second question about how to do this personal, how to organize, you know, all the things that must come together with the personalized learning pathways. And there are so many different opinions. What do you think about personalized learning as a future of education?
When I was at the OECD back in that day, working with the Center for Educational Research and Innovation, and we were doing work on the future of education, schooling for tomorrow, we had a conference. At the time, David Miliband was the minister in the UK, and we all got together and put together a book on personalized education. And I mean, it was very much in vogue also in industry. It was, mass customization, they called it. The idea of being able to scale customization, there was a lot of work being done on different ways of learning and how you need to customize to different ways of learning, et cetera. I mean, it was fascinating in a way, and this is the policy type story. There was a lot of emphasis, this was in the 90s, on the idea of creating portfolios and creating portfolios that were distinct learners' portfolios, because diplomas are bad signals. Diplomas do not give you much information. Diplomas are hierarchy-based. Diplomas are based on past performance. Diplomas don't tell you very much if you're an employer. And the evidence from economics and the studies of this is that most of the skills that people use on the job, they learn on the job. So what's all this about education?
What's the point of diplomas?
Yeah, what's the point of all that? And the discussion back then, and this is over 20 years ago, was, we have a problem in signal. Labor markets require transparency. They require competition and openness to function appropriately. And obviously, information is part of that good functioning. And so the question became, how are we going to create the conditions for transparency in capabilities? That turned into a whole effort to create equivalency of diplomas. But you can understand why. I ran a commission on the future of community colleges, as I mentioned, in Ontario. And the presidents of the universities, when we said we wanted to move to portfolio evaluation, which would validate but also recognize difference and differentiation, not uniform, standardized academic-type diplomas, or even skill-based, guild-based diplomas, which is where the practical diplomas come from. They said, we are going to walk away from this process and destroy it politically because it's valuable for them. Their system depends on it. They have to be able to sell the diploma and convince people that this works. And, this is not a minor issue. When I went to Tunisia, right after this was the time of the Arab Spring, and we were definitely experiencing the huge disappointment. But the same was true in Romania. When we did the future of higher education there in the early 2000s, there was this expectation of a linear relationship between entry into the elite, or let's call it stability, and diplomas, which was in fact, of course, an illusion based upon a system that was hierarchical and elite-based at the time. And then once it massifies, it becomes dysfunctional and causes a lot of disappointment and unhappiness. But we've never been able to project education to jobs in the future, because we live in this dynamic, creative world where the skills and the talents, but also everybody's career pathway. I always ask the question, are you doing what you expected you would do? No, you're not doing what you expected to do. And even if you're a doctor or a lawyer, generally speaking, what you're actually doing, you had no idea, because you're using your skills in a way that you didn't, in a context, in a situation that you didn't know. And this is one of the crucial aspects of futures literacy, to get back to what I do.
In a way, what you're saying is that this personalization of education remained in the past, and now it's more than personalized education. What we need is education that would give us skills, will teach us how to use skills for the future jobs. And the problem is that we don't know what the future jobs will look like.
what I think is crucial here is to realize that that idea of personalization is not just a supply-demand equation. Am I going to be the brilliant supplier as a school that supplies the personalized education to the demand which is being articulated? Let's keep this in mind. How do you know what you want? How do you know what you need to learn? How do you know what your learning techniques are? We've been very lopsided. We've been very imbalanced on the side of push. Push, we know. Push, we know what's good for you. Push, we know how. That's way too much. And it turns out to be wrong very often. But there's another question that if we move to pull, if we move to, I want to learn something, so therefore help me learn it, we have to be able to articulate that pull. We have to be able to have the confidence and knowledge that says, I need to know this. But even before you say, I need to know, what's the very, very first step? The very first step is saying, I don't know. And this not knowing is something that is actually excluded. It's considered a stain. It's not good. What do you mean you don't know? You're supposed to know. That's absurd. That's locking ourselves in this position of knowing, of pushing, not pulling.
You also mentioned that our education systems are very slow in changing. I would even say they are really conservative. And you've mentioned, the rectors of the universities being really reluctant to change. So do you think that actual real change will happen from the side of learners then, not from the side of educators?
I'm not a particular fan myself of zombie movies and things like that. But one wonders why in popular culture there's an affinity to the living dead. And it seems to me that many of our institutions today are exactly that. They're living dead. They're eating the brains of those who are alive. And they should just, finally give up and fall over and turn into good compost. I don't expect the zombies to suddenly turn into something new. They have their purpose. They have their structure. They have their continuity. They have their myths. These are very powerful things. And I have complete respect for the effort to squeeze every ounce of longevity they can out of their way of functioning. But I think it's gracious, but I also think more generous to also die and to leave space and to not try and repress, destroy, compete with things that are new.
Really? So if those are zombies, those really old-fashioned academic institutions, and you'd say it's better if they just, graciously die, what's next then, if those die?
That's what the forest is about, There are seeds that are growing. They're small. Some of them will become big. Some of them won't. They're there. But when there's a big storm or when there's a fire and the light comes in, they grow up. We want our societies to be healthy. Prolonging this grandiosity, this immortality, is not prudent. It's not generous. It's not creative. I think that rather than focusing all of our energy, and it's not to criticize the questions, but all of our energy on how to resuscitate, replace, prolong, extend the existing ways of doing things. But I think it's partly because of the way learning is approached in our society. You're supposed to know the answer to the test. And by privileging the idea of knowing what will come, privileging certainty over uncertainty, over not knowing, we create a dangerous imbalance in the kind of living in this universe. So my hope is that today's demonstrations by things like a pandemic, climate change, and in many ways, the disappointment we have with our institutions, the inability to avoid war, the inability to deal with fragmentation and inequality, all of these ills that we see around us provide us with an opportunity to look in the mirror and to ask ourselves some very basic questions. It's probably time for our species to become less arrogant and a little bit lighter.
Daryl, don't you think there is a part of the fault in this crisis? The education holds a responsibility for part of that.
I do think that the current education systems, which I believe are basically immune to significant reform unless we have another solution to keeping children off the street, and unless we have another solution to the behavioral aspect of showing up on time and listening to the boss. These are very, very central aspects of the current societies, industrial societies, etc. Unless we envisage other ways of doing that, schools are really the kind of bulwark of conformity and reproduction of the past. These institutions have a particularly specific functional relationship to the way the societies work. And parents get very frightened They think, what are my children going to do? I went to school. They should go to school. We need to repeat this cycle. What other way can we do it? And look, we know for a very, very long time that the efficiency of schooling as a learning mechanism is exceedingly low. We know that humans can learn when they want to learn, when they're driven by their own curiosity, by not knowing and engaging in discovery and play to understand the world. We're very good, actually. But that hasn't stopped us from continuing to perpetuate and sustain these institutions that are very ineffective, in fact.
Don't miss new episodes. Subscribe to this show on all platforms and share this episode with your friends. In our societies, failure is the most common word. Our kids, they have fear to fail. So do you think that the school should teach the importance of failure to the kids?
Probably my reaction to that is that you can't teach failure, you can experience it.
No, that schools provide a lot, I think.
But then it's how that experience is given meaning. And I think that's where the issue lies. I don't think that, you know, not knowing or something that does not go as expected, and this is, I think, one of the key aspects here, is that if the future is not predictable and you can't know it in advance, that we live in a non-deterministic world, then what you can do is experiment and learn from the experiment. And one of the key, I'd say, competencies there is to realize that you might not be getting the result that you expect because your expectations might not be formulated in such a way as to understand what's going on. And this is what we've discovered, of course, from science. Some of the greatest breakthroughs were not because the experiment succeeded. It's because the experiment kept on not producing the result they expected. And the problem wasn't the experiment. It was the theory. It was the hypothesis. It was the expectation that they had. So when I expect something and it doesn't turn out, I need to question my expectations as much as the outcome.
But don't you find that there is also an obsession of success? The word success is everywhere.
There's a lot of anxiety at the moment. And I wrote a little piece in my LinkedIn on despair. And I made the kind of little, you know, thought experiment, which says, well, what if we live in the time when there's the most despair ever? How would you know? But I think that one of the aspects of the current moment is to say, right now, we're fed up with looking for solutions because everybody's been proposing solutions. I'm going to solve the problem. We'll solve the problem. Let's solve the problem. So why be solutionist? And again, it has to do with changing our understanding of who we are, of our own agency, of our own responsibility, of our own arrogance and kind of omnipotence.
There is one very fancy buzzword speaking about education and skills development, which are soft skills. What do you think about soft skills?
Well, you know, if soft skills, soft powers, 21st century skills, competencies, I mean, the vocabulary does change over time. It's kind of symptomatic of a significant dysfunctionality if we have to say being able to be critical, being able to be empathetic, being able to adapt and communicate differently, if to say that these things are weak. If they're weak, yes, it's a problem. Because, you know, those are very fundamental aspects of being human. And one has to wonder why we're in a world where they're so weak. There was a time, by the way, to speak of a buzzword, you know, there was a time when the buzzword was wisdom. But in all the time that I've been a policymaker and in government and in universities, wisdom has never come back on the agenda.
In our previous podcast episode, we ranked the most important skills for the future with two amazing experts from ETF. And both of them agreed that critical thinking is the top one. Do you agree?
The thing that comes for me behind that is really this ability to let go. In other words, to distance oneself, to be able to not hang on to your own assumptions and your own point of view. And to me, that's not necessarily critical. It has to do with respect and humility. If I were to flag a capability to me today that would be the most important, I would say humility. Because I think humility is at the origin of the distancing that happens when you critique. Because when you critique, you're saying, well, something should be looked at from a different perspective. It should be seen in multiple lights. It might be good, it might be bad. My ideas about something can change because I've been able to critique it. But what stands behind that, prior to that, is this openness, the humility of not knowing, and the willingness to explore and to learn.
And humility is not something you learn in school, is it?
Probably a lot of people would say that you learn a lot about humiliation.
I would like to thank our speaker for this conversation, Riel Miller, Futures Literacy Expert. Thanks a lot, Riel.
My pleasure, and I hope it comes across as a conversation.
And thanks to all of you, our listeners. Goodbye, and stay tuned as there is much more to come.